everybody. Today is August 31st, 2023, and this is Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's Neuroscience Research Podcast. Welcome. Today we have with us one of our own faculty, Dr. Lindsay McPherson. Lindsay is an assistant professor in the Department of Neuroscience, Developmental and Regenerative Biology. And the reason that I thought we would talk today is partly because Lindsay gave a seminar and we usually have podcasts with our seminar speakers. And because even though Lindsay has attended the podcast and talked to other speakers quite a bit, we haven't ever really asked her to talk about her own work. So thank you for agreeing to do that.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks, Troy.
And with us also, Brian Fowler. Brian is a postdoc in Lindsay's lab. And welcome, Brian.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Lindsay, the taste is so interesting, but it's really confounded with smell. And most of the time when we say we're tasting things, we mean some combination of taste and smell, and we don't really sort it out for ourselves. And maybe it doesn't matter for us, but it matters to the scientists studying taste. So would you say something about that confusion and about the solution to the problem of what's taste and what's smell?
Sure. I think, we all think of taste as kind of flavor, typically. The reason behind that is obvious when you think about it. Whenever you're eating something, if the food goes in your mouth, you can taste the sweet, salty, bitter, sour, and umami tastes. But at the same time, you're getting the olfactory information. If something, you can smell lemon scents and citrus scents and savory scents, and all of this is happening all at the same time. I mean, you're chewing your food, you're getting little bits and pieces of that signal from your tongue, your taste buds, but you're also getting a lot of olfactory information. What people don't know often is that the olfactory information while you're eating, while the food is in your mouth, is a retronasal olfaction, and this is the sense of smell that you get from food within your mouth. And you can tell the difference really between taste and this retronasal olfaction if you clog your nose and take a bite. That way, because you've clogged your nose, there's no airflow back into the nasal passages. And so now you're just isolating the sense of taste alone. And you can tell then what you can perceive as flavor, which is a combination of smell and taste, and which is really taste alone. And so I think a lot of people don't recognize how simplistic taste is because of they're always having both at the same time. And you're making associations between taste and smell. And also beyond that, the mechanosensory feelings of crunching and munching and moving things around in your mouth. So all those things, including chemisthesis, which is additional sensory inputs from trigeminal neurons, which can signal the spiciness of something, and the temperature and somewhat of the texture of your food, altogether that creates flavor. So what I mostly study though is taste. And so that just brings it down to the five taste qualities: sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. And we kind of forget about the rest, although we're kind of interested in eventually looking at how those interactions happen and are sensed by her.
So what's the best way to actually know what is taste? I mean, obviously you could hold your nose and you could say, well, I can taste salty and amino acids taste funny, and but that's not how you do it, right? The way you define taste as the things that taste receptors respond to. And so ultimately it boils down to what are the taste receptors and what do they respond to. So that's how we know the five things that you just mentioned.
Right. So there's the five canonical tastes, which I mentioned. There are still out there people that think that there might be a couple others, and there's some evidence to think about calcium as being contributing to a taste. Calcium is also known as kokumi, which is a Japanese word that talks about like the taste that you have when you've been simmering like a stew for a long time, and it develops this kind of extra flavor that's beyond just umami. It's called kokumi, and they think it has something to do with the calcium levels, I think, in the food. That's interesting. Other people have looked for fat taste really extensively because everybody kind of feels like they can kind of have a sense of fat as a taste quality. And there's some evidence to suggest there might be a fat taste, but it's not fully conclusive yet. People also think about metallic as a taste too, but also yet not completely confirmed. So there's a couple of mystery tastings that might still be eventually included in the canonical five, or add some onto the list in the future. But for now, we mostly stick to the five.
So if there was another, I have definitely tasted that metallic taste, which is almost exactly the same thing that happens if you attach a, don't do this.
A battery.
You attach a battery. And you knew what I was going to say. And what is that?
So that is, I think that's just like straight up activating some neurons, uh-huh. and short wiring essentially your taste neurons, I think. I know whenever, like, if you peel off a candy and it's really sticky and you get some of that aluminum still stuck on there, sometimes you'll get that zing when you bite down on it and get like kind of the aluminum zing. I don't know exactly what the cause is that. It might be a combination of trigeminal activation, though, that gives you that kind of metallic.
But there's no metallic receptor, so.
And not that we're aware of. I mean, people have looked for, like, zinc or, different metal ions. But it's still not fully conclusive that there are at least... that there's taste receptors with those kind of properties.
Taste receptors aren't neurons. They make synapses onto neurons. So that's a big difference between taste and olfaction, where the olfactory receptors are neurons, really. So the taste receptors are kind of epithelium, I guess.
Yes.
And like lots of epithelia, they turn over all the time. But the neurons don't. And so there's this constant identity problem going on in the taste buds. And if each taste bud had a single kind of neuron innervating it, it would simplify things a lot. But it isn't like that, is it?
Yeah, so there is this weird phenomenon. It's not weird. I mean, it makes sense. You have turnover in the taste bud because your taste receptor cells are very close to the surface of your tongue. They're exposed to all sorts of things. There's a taste pore that all the tastings kind of float into, but that means that's also exposed to the environment, and you drink really hot coffee, you burn the surface of your tongue. All of those taste receptor cells could die off and fall off in the sheet. And then eventually, thankfully, you've got these population of reserve taste stem cells at the base of the bud that will turn over and replace that. So once... And there's this constant turnover just naturally, even if you don't harm your taste receptor cells, that most of them will die off in a period of about 10 to 14 days and be replenished. It sets up this problem where the neurons, they you don't get new neurons all the time. The neurons have to find their partners. And because of this problem of this intermingling of different taste receptor cell types within the bud, it creates this matching problem where they need to find their partner correctly. Otherwise, you would get a sweet cell signaling to a bitter neuron, and you would get, all sorts of crazy mismatch of information. So thankfully, your taste receptor cells have solved this problem in part from work that I did in my postdoc lab, identifying specific molecules that help match up the gustatory neurons to particular cell types.
But every taste bud has this problem in miniature because there's every different kind of, or almost every different kind of receptor cell
right.
at each taste bud.
Right. So individual taste buds are made up of all five or four to five different types of taste receptor cells. Each one are intermingled in the taste bud. And so, the neurons are all kind of finding their partners within this complicated environment. Each bud has 50 to 100 taste receptor cells. Some are signaling cells, some are more maintenance cells. You have this problem where you have to find the correct partner within the bud. And they're not all segregated, so you have one sweet bud, one bitter bud, one salty bud. Each taste bud has all of the different taste receptor cell types.
On the other hand, they're not all equally represented.
True.
I mean, at one point, people were saying that that space on the tongue really meant taste, and then it didn't. But now it kind of does a little bit again.
Right. So there's this kind of infamous tongue map that maybe you've seen in high school or elementary school science textbooks, and they always, you know, they always kind of like set up this experiment you can do with kids, and you just take a swab and dip it into some sugar water and then put it in the front of the tongue or the side of the tongue or the back of the tongue and ask, where do you sense it the most? And anyone who's tried to do this experiment in any real way has typically failed miserably, because that's not really how it works. That's not how our biology is set up. We do have taste receptors for all of the types kind of scattered around the tongue. There's no specified region. However, there are slight differences in the sensitivity levels, and that's what was initially reported, like back in the 1900s, in a PhD thesis by some German guy who was doing Honig, all this work.
Right. I think it was Honig.
Honig, yes, yeah. Honig was doing all this work, and he found that there were slight sensitivity differences, but mostly that was because of the density of the papilla. So, in the very front of the tongue, you have the fungiform papilla are very dense. You have quite a few of them right at the front. It goes a little bit less on the sides and then the back. So you notice these sensitivity changes, and relatively you could have some sensitivity changes in the front and the back and the sides. But that doesn't mean that there's dedicated spots for each of these things. Yeah. There is one true exception to that rule, and that is appetitive salt taste. So low salt concentrations, somewhere around 60 to 100 millimolar of sodium chloride, are attractive to mammals. And ENaC channels are, at least in mice, ENaC channels are responsible for signaling attractive salt taste. And only in the fungiform papilla, and not in the back of the tongue, the circumvallate papilla, only in the fungiform papilla at the front of the tongue are ENaC channels active and able to signal low salt taste. In the back of the tongue, you don't have those type of cells. You only have the high salt responsive cells that are kind of ionic / sour sensitive. And so that is one true kind of distinction between the fungiform and the circumvallate papilla in the very back of the tongue. So when we think of front and back of the tongue, though, in, you know, you and me and everybody down the street would just think of like, oh, the back of the tongue is like, you know, in the back, but the circumvallate papilla is actually really, really far back. You wouldn't want to touch your circumvallate papilla. It would probably make you gag. It's really halfway down your throat. And it's this very interesting structure that has these trenches. And it's very, very cool anatomy, morphology to it, where the taste buds are stacked right on top of each other and highly, highly concentrated along these trenches. And they're associated with some salivary glands and other things too. And so we were interested in kind of looking more closely at the differences of the signaling from the front of the tongue and the back of the tongue, the circumvallate papilla, which have kind of newly identified roles that have been different than just identifying whether something is sweet, sour, bitter, umami.
Yeah, because I mean, they're innervated by different nerves. They come from different developmental tissue. I mean, there are some significant differences there, but it's not like as simple as different taste qualities.
So Brian took on the effort to kind of look at this much more closely and do an apples to apples kind of comparison between the taste signaling from the fungiform papilla, which are innervated by the geniculate ganglion, and the circumvallate taste receptors, which are innervated by the petrosal ganglion, which is very kind of deep in your neck. So he did a kind of a heroic set of experiments to do calcium imaging to identify the activity profiles of individual ganglion neurons to what they were activated by when we flowed different tastes over the tongue.
I was so confident when I started that. Let's just say that like the stomach stretch response in there had me lulled into a false sense of security.
Stomach stretch response?
The gustatory neurons in the vagus are part of the petrosal, but in the mouse, that's sort of in this fused superstructure with the petrosal ganglion, the nodose ganglion, and the jugular. So the nodose actually innervates the stomach, the heart, the lungs. In case you're wondering, vagus comes from the Latin term for wanderer, which, that tells you everything you need to know about the innervation pattern. And stomach stretch is sensed by nodose neurons, which very easy to see that response. The taste response in petrosal neurons is a little less... those stomach stretch neurons are screaming, the taste neurons are speaking.
So the taste receptors are innervated by primary afferents from these two different
yes.
ganglia, but they're still taste. You know, it doesn't seem odd that there would be two completely different ganglia, one for the circumvallant papillae and one for the rest.
Or the fact that these really similar taste cells would come from different developmental tissue.
What we would normally, they're developmentally different.
Yeah.
What we normally think is, well, it must be they have different outputs, like they do different things. They take the same information, but they're sending it somewhere else to do two different things. But of course, sensory neurons are famous for collateralizing and sending information to lots of different places to do lots of different things. So it seems unnecessary, actually, to have... Is there a sense to it that makes sense out of it?
So it is. There is a kind of like some duplication of effort from these two pathways, but there are some specializations, and this is kind of why we're starting to look at this to see like what kind of inputs are more important for those ganglion neurons that innervate the back of the tongue. When you're eating, you know, the front of your tongue, you're sampling. You want to know like what you're eating. So that's kind of what people have thought of the geniculate ganglion, which innervates the front of the tongue. That set of circuits is really much more attuned to taste discrimination or identification. You want to know if you've tasted something salty or sweet or umami, and then, you know, compare if that's something you want to eat, continue to eat or not. Once the food hits the circumvallant papilla way back in the tongue, you're kind of halfway committed to swallowing this. And this is kind of like the point of last resort. If you've started to ingest something that may be poisonous to you, probably it's time to trigger a emesis reflex, right? Or a gag, or get this out of my system. And so it's been shown from a lot of work from Alan Spector and others that the circumvallant system, which is innervated by the geniculate from the petrosal ganglion through the glossopharyngeal nerve, is really much more attuned to or produces some of those gag and emesive like reflexes. Whereas at the front of the tongue, you can learn to gag from responses from the front of the tongue, but it's not a reflex. So this is kind of what started the whole idea of looking more closely at those responses and hopefully eventually tracking those circuits more closely. In the brainstem region, where all of the gustatory information feeds into, it is somewhat... segregated anterior to posterior. This region of the brainstem is called the nucleus of solitary tract. And in the more anterior portion of the solitary tract, that's where the information from the front of the tongue comes from. But as you go back, then you get the innervation from the back of the tongue. So there's a little bit of an anatomical organization to these inputs. So we were kind of looking there, but they're also somewhat intermingled too. So it's a messy circuit.
So the difference between these two ganglia, which seems like anatomically really distinct, when they end up in the nucleus in the brain, that distinction is much less clear.
It's cloudier. Yeah. There's some overlap and there's some segregation.
So I guess the remarkable, maybe seems obvious fact that the taste cell's specification is maintained in the ganglion cells, so a salty taste cell goes with a salty ganglion cell. But how far up the pathway can we expect that kind of segregation to continue?
So there is some taste-specific segregation almost at every relay that has been identified so far, all the way up to the gustatory cortex. There's areas that tend to respond much more specifically to sweet, to salty, to sour, etc. But there's also kind of some more generalizing going on too. So there's more like these are the attractive type of tastes, and these are the aversive type of tastes, and those will generalize more or less in different areas. So there is interesting circuits like within the amygdala that will kind of, you know, this is aversive, and you get the feedback from the amygdala, this is like a bad taste and this is a bitter signal, and that they can coordinate with each other to either enhance or inhibit your response to a certain taste. So you can learn, right, that broccoli is good for you and you should eat it even though it's bitter. And so it's kind of like a feedback mechanism. Our lab isn't quite, you know, gone into that in detail, but we're still sticking with the periphery to figure out where those inputs actually start going so it can eventually follow it more closely.
But the first thing is whether it ought to trigger some kind of reflex like you were just talking about.
Right. So the interesting thing is if you remove the brain, the cerebrum from the mouse, like the pretty much everything from the brainstem up, you will still, like if the brainstem remains, you will still be able to have the mouse produce attractive and aversive facial responses. So if you give a decerebrated mouse a sweet tasting, it will continue to lick that by reflex action. It will initiate the lick sequence and lick. If you give it a bitter substance, it will initiate a gape without a brain, just with the brainstem.
So you don't really need a brain to know what you like.
That's true.
So, of course, we're not really talking about what the mouse likes.
But the reflex action of the mouse, yeah.
So you were talking about this sort of gag reflex, but the front of the tongue is also triggering a lot of reflexes, like positive ones, and salivation, I guess.
And salivation. So this is something we've been looking at more once we found a interesting population of petrosal ganglion neurons that responded really strongly to umami tastings, MSG. And these neurons we thought were interesting because given like the relative proportions of taste receptor cells in the fungiform versus the circumvallate, we were expecting actually fewer umami responding neurons in the back because there's fewer cells there. But we found the opposite. There was this kind of extra responsive population of petrosal neurons innervating the circumvallate papilla. So we were thinking about what that could mean, you know, like why would the mouse want to have this kind of extra population? So we thought that it might have something to do with these kind of post-ingestive or intra-ingestive effects where you're eating something and umami is usually the taste that's associated for proteins and amino acids. And so when you're eating something that's highly, you know, full of protein, it breaks down into amino acids, you probably need more saliva to help break down the protein into its component parts. And so if that's the case, then umami might produce more saliva. And Brian worked it out so that he could probe that relationship between the umami stimulus in the front versus the back of the tongue and how much saliva the mouse would produce.
So what's the pathway for that? I mean, how direct is it to the salivary glands? What's the route?
I mean, we're still working on all the details, but from the brainstem, from the nucleus of the solitary tracts, it does go back into the... I wrote this in my thesis.
Reticular formation,
there we go. And from the reticular formation, it makes its way back out into the tongue.
So there's these salivary ganglion neurons that will actually trigger the salivary glands to release saliva.
But these are a completely different ganglion from the ganglia that are sensory ganglia.
Right.
Yes.
So there's some kind of connection, but it sounds like maybe it isn't direct. Yeah. Like the sensory neurons don't go directly to the motor neurons that control the salivary gland.
No, there's a relay in the brainstem.
Yeah, there's a relay in there.
Why? I mean, it's not for me to judge, obviously. but it seems that if it's that direct of a thing, it could just go straight. Is the salivary response highly modulated by other things, like other?
It can be, right? Because if you think of food, you start salivating right away. Yeah. So there's a lot of modulation of your salivary glands top down and all the way around.
Umami is a least identified and identifiable taste. If you ask people what are the tastes, a lot of people will forget about umami. Yeah. And When I'm thinking about it, like I've listened to you talk about it, I kind of know what it is, but I don't have a really clear image in my mind of what umami tastes like. So how was umami taste discovered and the taste cells for that discovered?
So the umami taste receptor was actually the first cloned and identified. So it's strange that it's the least recognizable of the taste qualities, but it was the first receptor to be identified and cloned. And it's much more well known in Japan, which is why it has the term umami, because it's a Japanese word for like yummy or savory. Right. And it was initially identified from, I forgot his name, but he realized that this like seaweed gave this really amazing flavor, and when he tried to like distill out the actual component of it, it was glutamate. So he found that glutamate was kind of like the mediator of umami flavor or umami taste, and so that kind of started it. And then once we kind of were able to do the molecular cloning, we identified T1R1, which was the first taste receptor cell to be cloned and identified, and it was the part of the umami receptor. You needed a T1R1 and a T1R3 GPCR together to create the umami receptor. For sweet, it's similar, but you need a T1R2 and a T1R3 co-receptor for the sweet.
So glutamate is sometimes said to enhance flavor of things. It's really just an extra
taste. It's an extra taste. But it's hard because most people don't, it's not as identifiable because most of the time when you're eating something that's high in umami, it also has other tastes and flavors to it. So I don't, like if you just straight up eat MSG from the bottle, it's MSG, so it has sodium in it, so it tastes a little bit salty, and then it has the umami flavor. MPG we have in the lab, it has no sodium taste, but the potassium kind of tastes, it gets a weird flavor to it too. So it is difficult to be as aware of it.
It's best to eat some seaweed if you really want to.
Yeah, hold your nose and eat some seaweed.
You have to hold your nose because it smells.
And make sure it's not salted.
Was here, I think he recommended a particular type of Parmesan cheese. I think.
So cheese is like, Parmesan has a good amount of glutamate in it. Tomatoes also do. Asparagus does. So some vegetables are relatively high in glutamate levels.
We probably know this taste really well. We just don't know the name of it.
Yeah.
So how do taste and smell get turned into that total experience? Like we have to go to trouble to separate them from each other. And so there must be some strong relationship between their connections. One of them is, from a neurophysiological, neuroanatomical point of view, they look completely different. They're in different parts of the brain. They operate in completely different ways. They have different kinds of receptors on their, different kind of receptor cells and different kind of receptor molecules. They have different projection pathways. How do they end up being one thing? We don't know that, but
it's partly because you're experiencing them always at the same time, like all simultaneously, And actually, the gustatory and the olfactory cortex is fairly close together. Uh-huh. They do kind of overlap in some regions, so that's partially why we we make these close associations, because the gustatory cortex and the olfactory cortex, piriform cortex, are very close. And then, they project together into the hippocampus and all these other places to form associations. And those associations become very, very strong. And, you can taste something, you eat a meal and it reminds you of your grandmother's cooking, and it will just, like, remind you of being in a certain place or with other people. And I think, eating a meal is such a social activity that brings everyone together, and just that dynamic of eating and being with people, you form that association very, very strongly. So these taste food memories become really, really important to us. And I think that's why it's hard for us to separate out the little pieces. It just helps you form that memory even better.
A taste buds seems a little bit more primitive than smell, and it has reflexes associated with it. I don't know any smell reflex. Are there smell?
There's maybe a little bit of in mice. If you smell something good, it'll kind of initiate a sniff, like a ramping up of sniff. So that's like one like kind of little reflex. I think if you smell something bad, you'll kind of try to inhibit your sniff. The taste reflexes are quite strong, and you can grimace with a sour. You really get a real good grimace from that, and gag reflexes can also be fairly obvious, especially in rodent models. Olfactory reflexes are not, yeah, like just the modulation of sniff rate is, I think, the only one that I know about. There might be more, but yeah, I think it is more primitive. Olfaction is a chemical sense, but you also need the contact. You know, you have to be in really intimate contact. You know, something is in your mouth to be able to taste it, and so. Because you're kind of allowing something into your body, you're taking a risk in eating that thing. You want to be sure that this is going to be nutritious and not harmful to you. So I think that's kind of that's the primitive aspect of taste, where it's kind of a big decision to make.
Is there any situation where people lose their taste but keep their smell? I mean, is that a...
There is a thing. So there's agusics that have lack of taste, but anosmics are people that can't smell. And there's overlap too of people who have lost complete taste and smell. I know a lot of people during COVID had that issue and even lost chemisthesis, which is amazing to me, because they've lost their ability to detect, you know, capsaicin, hot chili peppers in their food or anything like that. So that still amazes me that you could lose all of the above. In a brief amount of time. Most people have regained that ability to detect smell and taste and chemisthesis again after their COVID symptoms recover. But it's just amazing to me that all of those could be wiped out in one go. But yeah, some people have lost sense of taste. It's usually not as bad, right, as losing your sense of smell, because I think it does make food much less palatable when you don't, especially salts. I mean, we most of us take for granted like how much salt is so good, and sweetness too. But I think just in a general meal, if you're not having a dessert, like this, the salt content in your food can make a huge difference. You know, right, when the cook has not put enough salt in the food, and you very much know if they put way too much salt in their food, right? So that can really completely change your ability to enjoy a meal, is the level of salt seasoning in the food. And that's purely taste.
Well, thanks for that. I hope I can always enjoy my taste and smell together. So that's a good place to stop, I think. Thank you very much, Lindsay and Brian. And this has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.